Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm a very sad Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, why are you sad?
Erin, you have news.
I have news. I'm going away on maternity leave, and this is my last show until I come back. So hold it down, Alyssa.
Erin, I will try to ably hold down the fort.
Yeah, I'm taking some time off to birth and keep a tiny baby alive, and I will be back mid-August is my target. But in the meantime, guys, we have a blockbuster lineup.
We have some good people. We have some fun. We're not going to tell you about it now because you need to wait and find out.
But it's going to be so good because Alyssa Mastromonaco is better than literally anybody else I've ever met at making friends and getting people to want to do things with her.
Thank you.
So I feel like, listeners, you are going to be so excited. By the time the middle of August rolls around, you're going to be like, Erin who?
Oh, it's the doldrums of the summer. I'll be like Alyssa who?
We're not going to know who we are, none of us. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people whose Kendrick v. Drake is Jasmine Crockett v. Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Reporting for duty.
Reporting for duty. And I'm glad MTG is in the Drake position in that versus because...
What a wreck.
Jasmine Crockett is 100% the Kendrick. And if any... I want to avoid any confusion. She is the
All-star.
Kendrick. Although that is pretty mean to both... Somehow both Drake and Marjorie Taylor Greene to compare them, to compare them to each other. I guess both of them... pretend to be from places that they're not really from.
Yes.
Or like mine the culture of places they're not really from.
So I think so boring.
Marjorie Taylor Greene has never really like lived in her district. She bought a house there. Yeah.
Just because.
And Drake is, you know, from Toronto. So there you go.
Snooze.
Snooze. Okay, let's just get to the news. Republicans are talking about birth control. I'm going to say this. Between now and the election, a lot of Republicans are going to come out and try to present themselves as reasonable on things like birth control, IVF, and abortion. Think about them like you would think about a guy that would say anything that it takes to get into your bedroom or your pants. They don't care what it takes to get them there. That is all they want to do is to get into office, and then they are not going to do any of the reasonable things that they claim they're going to do. And some of the things that they're claiming are reasonable are not in fact reasonable. And they're all fucking lies. They lie. They will lie and say whatever they need to say to get elected and then fuck you. Because that's what they do.
They are the boy sophomore year that's like, I do love Lifetime movies.
Or I do love you.
It's like, that too. It's like I was a lower bar.
Yeah, mine was really, really dark. Okay, so... former President Donald Trump, who does not seem to be well, I'm going to just say that, has a really confusing stance on contraception. He did an interview with Time magazine that was a really long and terrifying read maybe about a month ago and claimed that he'd be releasing a big statement regarding mifepristone and contraception. He said it would come within a couple weeks, like his healthcare plan and like his infrastructure plan. No such statement has come. And this week on social media, he said that people are spreading misinformation if they say he might restrict birth control. However, in an interview with a Pittsburgh TV station, he said he would consider restrictions on contraception.
He was going to come out with a plan. He was going to come out with his contraception plan.
And everybody was going to like it. He's looking at contraception. I cannot reiterate strongly enough that it is very creepy that the compromise for these people is letting a bunch of elected men decide what you are allowed to do with your body. That is so fucking weird and convoluted. And why?
And you know, nothing he says is trustworthy or his campaign when he says something and then the campaign rushes out to correct it.
Yes. But ultimately, if he were to be reelected president, he can say things that have repercussions that are immediate. He can sign things and all that has to happen is for one far right anti-abortion zealot, anti-contraception zealot to get in his ear. And we've got like a nationwide ban on IUDs.
And they're everywhere, Erin. They are everywhere.
They are everywhere. Yeah, so don't trust Donald Trump in any of the things that he says about abortion, birth control, or contraception, because he, A, doesn't have a plan. B, is scared to have a plan because it's really him stepping on rakes over and over again. Yeah. And C, he's a liar. So there you go. And it's just so creepy when he talks about women's health.
Because he's always like a little sweaty. You know what I mean? It's just like, no.
He's got like Ozempic neck real bad now.
He does, doesn't he?
It's
went too high too fast.
It looks like the part of a cave that if you went there on an elementary school field trip, the boys would point and laugh at it and say it looked like a vagina.
Well, yes. And here's the other thing. He's always notoriously bought his suits too big because he thinks it makes him look thinner. But he's also clearly too cheap to buy new suits. So now he just looks like his neck is like out here. He's a wreck.
He's not doing well.
He's a wreck.
Melania is not giving him any advice about anything at all.
I'm waiting for his hair dye to start dripping down the side of his face like Rudy Giuliani in his new coffee line.
God, Rudy Giuliani. You almost feel bad for the guy because
he's a mess too.
He's an absolute mess. Let's talk a little bit about Virginia Governor Youngkin. We kind of sleep on him. He's really bad. And he's bad and lazy. He's bad and lazy. Alyssa, why don't you take that away?
So here's the problem with old Wunkin Yunkin. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin vetoed a bill that would have codified access to contraception in the Virginia state law. Now, Aaron, worth noting that he has done nothing more aggressively than veto bills. He has vetoed 201 bills in a single term.
Okay.
Okay.
So he's kind of like evil Tony Evers.
It's like someone gave him a stamp and he got really excited to use it, and that's all he does.
He got excited to use it, but like in the dark of night. Secret.
With a fleece vest on.
In a cloak. So nobody can take pictures because what he's doing is very unpopular. But he's doing it anyway. He can't help himself.
So when he was asked why he did this, he said that access to contraception is codified federally through Griswold v. Connecticut.
No, it's not.
Yunkin Wunkin. He said, moving forward, quote, and this one, Aaron, you know this one gets me. He said, quote, any contraception-related changes must be coupled with robust conscience clause protections for providers and must also uphold the fundamental rights of parents to make decisions concerning their children's upbringing and care. Okay, Aaron, what more needs to be done for the conscience clause than it just simply existing? Like, the conscience clause is, if you are a pharmacist and you don't believe in something, you can respectfully step aside and let another pharmacist or pharmacy employee handle that order. That's what's supposed to happen. What more does he want?
I don't know. I think he's, again, like, he knows that there is no way for him to win on this issue. Either he pisses off everyone who got him elected, like his base and his donors, or he pisses off normal people.
Yeah.
And there's way more normal people than there are base and donors for Glenn Youngkin. So he's trying to kind of have his birth control and eat it too.
Gross.
I know. Sorry. By saying that, like, yeah, well, I'm not going to codify access to contraception into state law because there's a very flimsy precedent in place has been in place since the 60s, even, you know, ignoring the fact that the Supreme Court has no problem overturning established precedent.
Roe was codified until a year ago.
Yeah. This is just really weaselly stuff.
Par for the course.
And of course, you know, it's interesting that he falls back on his favorite little hobby horse, rights of parents, because that's what got him elected. Listeners might recall that people in Virginia were angry about the school closing whiplash during COVID, and that's literally how he got elected. So he's trying to pretend that somehow conscience and you know, contraception is somehow tied up in parent morality and whatever, and it's confusing and it makes no sense. Speaking of things that are confusing and make no sense, Senators Ted Cruz and Katie Britt say that they're going to codify IVF access and protect life at the same time. Alyssa, how are they going to do that?
They're not, Aaron. They're not. It's again, this was an easy breezy op-ed. Here's the problem. The headline the Wall Street Journal gave us says they're going to codify IVF, which sounds good. Sounds good. The one question before I ever read the article was, what about the embryos? Because that's actually the problem. Mm-hmm. What about the embryos? Well, Aaron, they hoped that this bill would address the quote-unquote confusion that arose after the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that IVF embryos should be considered children. So what these two say is, yes, we are definitely, you guys, everyone should have access to IVF. We want more babies. We want more children. Here's the problem. As Jess Valenti points out in her newsletter today, the language of the bill defines IVF as, quote, the practice whereby eggs are collected from ovaries, manually fertilized by sperm, and later placed inside the uterus. The limited definition is very deliberate. They aren't objecting to the process of retrieving eggs and fertilizing them. The issue is what happens to the frozen embryos, which they do not address. Discarding unused frozen embryos is a very normal part of the process, but the pro-life groups, Aaron, they don't like it. They don't like it. And beyond that, anti-abortion activists want to limit the number of embryos created and then want to dictate how they are used. Landmines are everywhere. This was nothing but putting lipstick on a pig.
That's exactly what the Alabama Supreme Court ruled should happen. So they're trying to make that nationwide.
Yes.
Like, they're trying. Okay, so my first thought before I got into the bill was that they were going to try to walk that ridiculous line where it's like, oh, it's only a child if it's in a woman's body, which is like ridiculous. But no. What this bill would actually do is reinforce the Iowa ruling that, like, oh my God, nice try. God, Katie Britt's a creep.
Creep. Also, doing it with Ted Cruz, extra creepy.
Yeah. What?
Like, Ted, what do you have to say on this matter?
All right. You know what? Our party is having a real problem with women. Let's team up. Let's team up like a robotic wife, O'Matic, gave a speech from her kitchen with...
I was going to say, I'm surprised they didn't do an Instagram live from her kitchen.
I mean, honestly, and let's team her up with the man that women find least appealing in the entire Senate.
Man who left his dog alone on vacation.
Is there anybody less appealing to women than Ted Cruz?
No.
I'm just trying to think of like a senator that's like grosser. Even like Mark Wayne Mullen.
I was going to say Marco Rubio, and then I was like, no, still not as gross as Ted Cruz.
No, Marco Rubio, I think, is like a little twerp, but not gross. Like, he doesn't gross me out, you know? But yeah, Ted Cruz. Who made this decision to write this op-ed? And why?
Those two were in the Republican caucus, and they were like, have we got an idea for everybody?
Oh, my God. Somebody should have spoken up and been like, don't. Okay, more abortion news. Good news from Nevada. Nevadans for Reproductive Freedom announced on Monday they've reached 200,000 signatures, which is enough to advance a ballot measure that would enshrine abortion rights into the Constitution. Nevada needs excitement this year.
Yes, yes.
Excitement. There has been some kind of disturbing articles recently about how Democrats used to have kind of a hold on Nevada, and this year it is a really important state. And getting voters excited to show up to vote for Joe Biden and to keep the Senate blue, we really need some enthusiasm there. So having it at the ballot box is really important. Oh, more good news about this. The 200,000 signatures is double the threshold required to qualify for the November 2024 election. So that bodes well in terms of voter excitement. Currently, Nevada does allow abortions up to 24 weeks for an elective procedure. And later, if there is a serious issue with the health of the mother or the health of the fetus. So Nevada's already got it good, but they're just trying to make it so that it's like locked in.
Yeah. They're like, because that's what people have to do.
You got to lock it in. Sam Alito is up to no good.
What a wreck.
Sam in Alito, as we call him.
Sam in Alito.
Oh, God. I always just, whenever I picture him, my first thought is him in those pristine waiters that clearly have not seen more than 2 hours tops of outdoor action, holding up a fish that he almost certainly did not catch next to a billionaire. That's why we call him Salmon Alito. So what's Alito gotten himself into this?
Well, Aaron, New York Times had a little story about how Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito flew an upside down flag outside his home following Biden's win in the 2020 election. Reminder, because honestly, and this is what's honestly, the Republicans have to stop with the flag. It is like outrageous.
Yeah, leave it alone.
Just leave the flag alone.
Quit coloring on it. Quit coloring on it, turning it upside down, making it black and blue. I saw a green one the other day, one with a green line. And I was like, what the fuck is the green line?
I got to be honest. I usually Google because I'm like, what's that one mean? What are all these different stripes? But the funny thing about their use of the flag is that the whole point of the flag is that you're supposed to respect it. It's not supposed to get wet. It's not supposed to drag on the ground. Meanwhile, people are just out there flying the flag from their truck in the middle of a rainstorm. And it's like, you literally are using, like, you're disrespecting something that you think it's too much for me. But the upside down flag used to serve as a distress signal, right? That's what it meant.
I wish it served as a distress signal in Sam Alito's.
Used to be a distress signal.
He slipped and fell in the bathtub or something.
These guy, the MAGA folks started flying the flag upside down in reference to their Stop the Steal movement related to the 2020 election. So a Supreme Court justice outside his house just flying a Stop the Steal flag.
Oh my God. I cannot keep up with all of the symbology involved in their adult Goonies style LARPing.
100% so Goonies. Ridiculous. Yes. Like, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Judicial experts are like, this is no bueno. This is not cool. Like, you should not be. It's like a clear violation of the ethics rules that we know barely exist. But you know what he did when he got caught? Aaron, he blamed his wife.
You know who else did that? Adam. God. A lot of people blame women.
Let's see who else. Who else is blaming women?
Christian tradition.
He was like, Martha Ann Alito, she flew it upside down. I had nothing to do with it. If you look at the picture, the flag was like at his garage. Like, if you pull out your car, how did you not see it? Plausible deniability is not effective in this case.
Oh my God. Blaming women is so biblical. Blaming women is incredibly, like, Lot's wife is turned into a pillar of salt because she looked back as they were fleeing Sodom and Gomorrah. So,
well, I mean, and look, it worked for his brother, Clarence Thomas. Blame Ginny for everything that happened. He was like, oh, Ginny accepted that. Ginny did this. But also, Aaron, men blaming their wives is not just a Republican thing, because Bob Menendez's entire defense right now in his criminal trial seems to be based on blaming his wife, who was diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm not laughing about the breast cancer, and is about to undergo a mastectomy. What?
Oh, my God. That is, wow. Yeah.
That is uncool.
Yeah. That's a deal breaker, ladies. Your husband throws you under the bus like that. Also,
yikes. Time to take those gold bars, Mrs. Menendez, and head to another jurisdiction.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of countries that don't have extradition orders with the U.S., and they're pretty easy to get to. Not that I'm giving advice on how to break the law, but.
But I mean.
Oh God, that is so shitty.
It's cringe.
Mrs. Alito, and Alito's excuse was Mrs. Alito placed it in response to a neighbor's use of objectionable and personally insulting language on yard signs.
Now,
grow up.
Also, an anti-Trump sign is not the equivalent of saying an election was stolen.
Yeah, that is so.
Not the same. Go ahead and put your Trump sign up, girl.
There's something so funny about Alito thinking, like, you know what is an excuse that people will buy? If my wife was in a childish fight with some neighbors, like.
My wife is a petty bitch.
My wife is like fucking.
As women are.
No, but that's the thing.
Control her emotions, as women can't.
Okay, I'm sorry. As a petty bitch, I gotta say, that is not a creative solution to a petty problem. petty bitch comes up with something much better than just like flying an upside down flag. That makes you look stupid.
Because we know some petty bitches.
We are some petty bitches.
We are petty bitches.
When the situation calls for it, we are petty bitches. Yeah.
Honestly, hysteria@crooked.com if you need better ideas.
Yes, 100% hysteria@crooked.com. Incorporate some of the anti-Trump signs into a funny Halloween display that year.
Featuring, make a collage.
Featuring zombies that resemble your neighbors. That would be a funny petty bitch thing
Super
to do.
Funny.
Super funny. Like, sorry, Mrs. Alito, Martha Ann, if you're listening. Yeah, come on. That's, no, you're lying, Sam Alito. Never miss an excuse to be a dick.
You're lying and you're boring.
And one more thing I wanted to talk about today is when we were putting the show together this week, because this week has felt so long, because I think so much dumb shit has happened, Alyssa and I were both like, oh yeah, this happened after we did the show last week. We must talk about it.
Must.
One of our favorite people in Congress is Representative Jasmine Crockett of Texas. We recently had her on the show. She is absolutely a delight. And last week, she got into it with Marjorie Taylor Greene during a committee hearing. So here's the thing. Marjorie Taylor Greene insulted her for no reason during a committee hearing that was, on its face, stupid. It was about whether or not to hold Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress because Republicans,
snore.
I know, Republicans would rather do literally anything than their job, which is to make and pass legislation. Like, do your fucking job. They're useless. So they're in this useless committee hearing. Marjorie Taylor Greene insulted Jasmine Crockett's false eyelashes, and AOC jumped in and was like, hey, you apologize. That's not called for. There was a lot of kind of like blah, 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 blah.
And my favorite thing, Aaron, right in this moment is that AOC knows the rules of committee better than the heads of the committee.
Yeah, which is
because she was calling them out on procedure and they were like, wait, what? Is this true? And it's like, yeah, dude, she's correct.
Yes. Okay. So she was calling them out on stuff and the guys in charge were sort of like just big, dumb guys, not really knowing what to do. They didn't do anything really beyond just being like, hey, ladies, don't. Jasmine Crockett fired back in this really incredibly indirect, shady way where she didn't even mention Marjorie Taylor Greene's name. She said, she referred to Greene as a beach blonde, bad build, butch body, alluded to the fact that it was Greene.
No notes.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene instantly acted like wounded, which is, you know, just classic. And it was really funny. Jamie Raskin's face, I think, was the co-star of that. He did not know what to do.
It's like, I don't know what to say. Like, and honestly, if you're just a white man in that situation, that's the correct response. There's nothing for you to say.
Here's the thing. If the girls are fighting, and they are, which is absolutely fine by me, I actually just wrote my first column for Esquire this week.
Yes. Can we link it in show notes?
Yeah, I think we can link it in show notes. It's gonna go up. But I wrote about this exchange and how, you know, the whole when they go low, we go high thing doesn't work for everybody. And I think it's really refreshing as a Democrat to see somebody stand up for themselves. Like, we don't always have to sit there and take it. Like, not every Democrat needs to fire back. Like, beach blonde, bad build, butch body is a banger of an insult. And, and Crockett just had it there. Let her be herself, you know? Like, not everybody needs to try to be Jasmine Crockett. But I don't think that we should try to prevent people like Jasmine Crockett from firing back.
Let
Jasmine be Jasmine. I actually think that as somebody who's kind of tired of watching Democrats just like slave over being adults in the room, mm-hmm. like you don't, you know what? Eventually you get pushed too far and you are in the right to say something kind of rude back. Was it rude?
Yes.
Yes. It was
totally. Especially when the clapback is perfect.
Yeah. And it's been remixed. I just think that it's, I don't think that it is like a time to be like, what? Oh, civility, civility, civility. No, come on. Let's like not be lobotomized by this like complete illusion of civility in DC because it's not a civil place. And I think that there's something really respectable about people who hit back when they've been insulted. And but, yeah.
Erin, it gets even better, doesn't it? You got to tell the punchline.
Beach blonde, bad built, butch body has been trademarked.
Yes.
And Representative Crockett is now selling Crockett clapback merchandise, and the proceeds from it support the reelection of Democrats and the taking of the House. So maybe that something adult can actually get done there.
You know what I'm going to get you as a post-baby present now.
Oh, my God. That, I would wear it. I would 100% wear it. And I think a lot of people in my neighborhood would recognize and know what that meant. one more thing. Harrison Butker is just an idiot. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Eddie Vedder, who is still...
Icon.
He's still such a dreamboat, like such an icon. And he's just great. But Eddie Vedder called him a fucking pussy.
Which wasn't even the best part, because Eddie, who, by the way, I just have to remind everyone, I aspirationally dressed like in high school, large flannel shirts and hair like he had in the video, Jeremy. Uh-huh. He said, quote, "It's not a graduation speech. The irony was that the football player, well, kicker. You see, the kicker doesn't have the pads because he doesn't tackle anybody or get tackled. But he started. He was telling men, don't forget to puff up your chest and be more masculine. Don't lose your masculinity." And then he called him a fucking pussy. So it's like, oh, the pussy part, I don't know. But the rest, making it sound like he had the weakest position on the football team, I felt like that was really going to get him where it hurt.
I mean, imagine if you made Eddie Vedder. Look, honestly, I would much rather be married to Eddie Vedder than Harrison Butker.
Oh, 100%.
Like 100%. I think most people would. Men and women would be.
Look at my iPhone playlist. You'll see where I come down on this.
Okay, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I have an interview with one of the producers for the original Teen Mom.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Spring Sale and get 35% off paints and stains March 13th through the 23rd. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Shop the Sherwin-Williams Spring Sale and get 35% off paints and stains March 13th through the 23rd. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who know that the true golden age of MTV was the Y2K era. I don't think we're going to have any disagreement there. Our guest today is a former producer of the MTV shows 16 and Pregnant, Teen Mom, and a couple of Teen Mom spinoffs. Now she's a producer as well as a writer who focuses on telling stories about women and power. Kenda Greenwood Morin, welcome to Hysteria.
Thank you so much.
I'm so glad you're here. Can you just... First of all, explain how you became involved in the OG version of 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom.
Oh, great question. I had been working on, you know, a variety of different reality shows. I kind of fell backwards into working on unscripted television and documentary television. And I came up working on a show called Wife Swap.
Oh, I know that show.
Yeah. And then I was looking for my next gig, and I happened to just socially know Morgan J. Freeman, who was an executive producer who had been doing a lot of work with MTV. He's wonderful. And, he had a little something that he was working on, a little pilot. He was like, we're doing this little documentary for MTV. It's about teen pregnancy. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you'd be interested. So he sent me a couple of scenes that they had shot, and it was so, it was just so raw. It was just out there, you know, with the girls who were pregnant, who were dealing with all that it is to be a teenager and pregnant in America at that time. And I watched it and I was like, yeah, I definitely want to be involved in this. And we went and we just made 6 episodes of a documentary series that no one thought anyone would watch. You know, it was like, this feels important. It feels super relevant to the MTV audience. But like, is anyone going to see it? Who knows? So they gave us a lot of freedom to just kind of tell their stories the way they really were happening, which was really nice. And then it was really a surprise when everyone watched it, when it really blew up. And then that was when we were like, well, the stories really are just starting when the babies are born. Mm-hmm. There's so much more. There's just so much more to see and deal with as a teen parent than there is as a teen pregnant person. I mean, both are crazy. And so it just kind of continued on from there. But it was really a surprise to all of us. It was crazy.
I remember it was a full-on phenomenon. Like everybody watched those shows. Everybody talked about, even people, like I was not in high school at the time, I was past high school. And even then people were watching it as like adults were watching these shows. One criticism that the shows got, and in many cases unfairly, and before they even like really had aired and the cultural impact had sunk in, was that reality is inherently sort of exploitative to its subjects. How did you try to work around that? How did you try to prevent exploiting the subjects of the shows?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of people think about those shows as reality TV. At that time, our approach was really documentary. We really thought of ourselves as like partners to tell the stories that those young women, girls at the time, were going through, and working with them to tell those stories. The word reality TV sometimes connotes putting people into positions that they wouldn't normally be in. Mm-hmm. But in these shows, this was their lives. This was their real lives. And we were just kind of documenting, this is what their real life looks like, and working with them about what they were comfortable showing and talking about. And also in the beginning, I think the girls, nobody knew that it was going to be what it became, this mm-hmm. big phenomenon. So I think that we all sort of were really interested in like showing people, hey, this is what it's really like. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. And the girls were really invested in that as well. And like saying, you know, putting their stories out there in that context so that other kids their age could learn from them. Mm-hmm. And with that motivation behind them, I think that really propelled the show to come from that perspective rather than, you know, a sort of like evil producer with an idea of how this should be kind of a perspective.
Right, right, right. Like that show that was about the behind the scenes of The Bachelor and how like
Unreal.
Yes. Yeah. As a producer, did you watch Unreal?
I did.
Did you find any aspects of it relatable, or did you recognize anything from the industry that you were like, oh, yep, that's it?
I think that there are definitely things that they got right that exist in the industry. And most of them were taken, obviously, much farther than than would happen in real life.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that was interesting about that show was some of the moral quandaries that the producers found themselves in terms of like when you have a person who's really struggling and they're on television, like what is your responsibility to, you know, to that person? And that I found to be, that was to me the most interesting part of that show. And I think is really real that like, being on television is hard, you know, like you're putting your story out there, putting your real life out there in this way that people can comment on and criticize. And when you're young, especially, like that puts you in a challenging place. So I thought that that was an interesting question that show played with, of like, what is it? Yeah, what does it mean to kind of put your story out there, and how does that make you vulnerable?
Right. Well, like the price of great television from a reality or documentarian's perspective is sometimes like, I have to show this person in a state of crisis to fully tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
But like, where does the intervention happen? Were there any moments when you were making any of the 16 and pregnant teen momiverse shows that you were like, I feel conflicted about how we should handle this moment?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the nature of any show that's about someone struggling, any documentary that's about someone struggling, is that you find yourself wanting to intervene in some way, or wanting to be the shoulder that they cry on, or wanting to. So these questions do come up for sure, and I worked with that cast for years and I developed a relationship with them and I came to really care about them. And so these questions come up, like, when is it my responsibility to say like, oh, no, you're putting the diaper on backwards, or, you know, or something more serious than that. And in general, you know, because we came from a documentary perspective, there were things that from a moral perspective you had to intervene on, and then there were things where it was like, okay, I'm documenting and that is that person's choice to make.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even like, if I wouldn't make that choice, right, that's that person's choice to make.
Right. Like, they forgot to buckle their baby in the car seat.
Right. If there's a physical danger or something like that, that's a different thing than like, you know, that's a choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, you know, the show is airing, it's a huge hit. So that's like kind of wave one of you realizing like the influence of it. Wave two is there's been academic studies done about the show's impact on culture. And there have been, you know, economists who have found, I found a paper in like the National Economic Council, whatever, that was like the teen mom effect. And it showed that teen mom's popularity coincided with a huge drop in teen births in the U.S., When did you first realize that the show was doing that? And did you ever have aspirations for the show to do that as you were first making it?
100% for me, that was what I wanted the show to do. You know, it was always conscious when we were documenting the stories of like, we want to make sure we see the hard stuff. And those were the conversations sometimes I would have with the cast, is like, you know, no one wants to show when they're struggling with something. They mm-hmm. That's not a comfortable thing to expose to the world. But I was always coming from that perspective of like, if we make it look easy, no one's going to know how hard this is. You know, we don't want to put a story out there that's like, oh, it's so fun to get pregnant when you're 16.
Right, my super sweet teen pregnancy.
Exactly. So that was our way into kind of telling those harder moments, showing the struggles, showing the things that you don't get right off the bat, you know, showing how hard it is to juggle work and a relationship that was not prepared for parenthood and having your own parents and high school and, you know, all of those things. Like, it was really hard to juggle. So it was critical. I mean, I think that just speaking for myself, but also knowing that, like, from a larger perspective, we all were really invested in making sure that it looked as hard as it was and that that came through in the stories that we were telling. So we were delighted that it did, you know, that it seemed like that really did come through. I think the New York Times put out a piece, I don't know, it was probably 2010 or something like that, where they reported, you know, they sort of credited the show with being at least partly responsible for a drop in teen pregnancy in America. And we were like, that's great. That's exactly what we were hoping that people would see and want to take steps to avoid. Because the thing that I found most surprising in kind of traveling to some of the communities where a lot of teenagers were getting pregnant was I assumed that for every single one of them, it was a shock and an accident and not something that they wanted. And for the girls that were on the show, that was true. It was all an accident. But there were other girls in the community that I was really surprised. They sort of had this idea that, like, well, maybe if I have a baby, I'll have someone who always loves me, or I'll get to, you know, keep my relationship. Or, you know, there were other young women that I met that had a fantasy about what it would mean to get pregnant as a teenager that was just like so far off from the reality of what it would actually mean. So we really wanted to show the reality.
Yeah. Well, so you're a mother now. You have a young child. And you know, after working on a show that highlighted how difficult it is to go through pregnancy and birth and have a young child, like, have you gotten a new perspective since becoming a mother on the show and that experience?
100%. I mean, first of all, I think I underestimated when we were making the show how much they were juggling between being on television and having a new baby, or having a toddler, or having, you know, now that first generation of kids is about to turn 16, you know?
What? No.
Yeah.
What?
Bananas.
No.
I know.
Oh, stop. What is time? That's crazy.
Yeah. But I knew because I saw it. I knew how hard it was, but I didn't know it firsthand. And now, having gone through that first year of parenthood and now being in the toddler years, I'm like, I just have that much more respect for everything that they were going through.
Yeah.
In terms of like trying to imagine juggling a camera crew in my home while I'm trying to learn how to breastfeed and all of that other stuff is just, it's, I have a huge amount of respect for them.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Chasing a toddler around and trying to wrangle call times and stuff, that would be really hard. Also, like, with the emotional maturity that teenagers have is not generally high. I cannot imagine me as a teenager taking care of a toddler. It's just emotionally.
It's really hard. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that I waited as long as I did to have kids, because I was like, I don't know if I'm ready yet. I'm 35. Don't know if I'm ready yet.
You'll invite a camera crew for 35 and pregnant
exactly.
to your house. I mean, it never feels like the right time, but I think that this show really highlights how beneficial it is for you to have like a degree of emotional maturity, financial stability, and good people surrounding you.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that was always kind of, some of it was subtextual and some of it was very overt on the show, is that some of these girls didn't have the greatest people around them. Were there any cast members or any moments where you just kind of really, really hated one of the people that was kind of orbiting one of the Teen Mom cast members?
Sure. I mean, I don't know if I would use that word, hated. I think one of the things that really hit home for me working on this show was how much everything is generational, and it's just sort of passed down and passed down and passed down. And that, like, it's very hard to show up in a way that no one showed up for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see that happen sometimes, how hard it was for parents to show up for their teenagers, how hard it was for, you know, just everyone around them to show up in certain ways. There were also people who were tremendously supportive and amazing. But that there were certainly moments where I wished that these girls had more support. I wished they had more people in their community that could help, could be a powerful, positive example for them, all of that stuff. And it made me mad sometimes, for sure. But, you know, I had a lot of, and I still have a lot of compassion for the fact that I really think that they, most of them were showing up to the very best ability that they had.
Mm-hmm.
Because they probably didn't have a lot of support when they were that age. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of goes back and back and back, which is why I'm really proud of some of the cast members who really have broken that cycle and really have kind of like stepped out of absent parenting or addiction or all of these things that I think a lot of people deal with and have created a better life for their kids. Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing to do that under those circumstances sometimes. Mm-hmm.
So at the time that you were making the show, a lot of sex education programs were being defunded, especially in places where some of these girls lived. Did you find that the culture wars around that ever came for you or the show because you were kind of providing a sex education in a way that their communities and their schools weren't?
I mean, not for me. I was never out there as the face of the show, and I'm not the face of the show. You know, I am one producer of many who worked on the show and happened to be there, you know, when we first started. But certainly there was backlash. And certainly, I mean, the way that I mostly experienced it was in the communities, that there would be certain family members or certain community members who would kind of pull me aside and say, like, what you're doing is evil. You know, what you're doing is wrong.
On what grounds? Were you just like giving them too much information or what were you, what did they think was evil about it?
I think that we were putting people on TV who had had sex, premarital sex, you know?
That's true. Acknowledging that sex exists is itself a sin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though we are all evidence of sex
by
our very existence.
But, you know, these were all people who had clearly had premarital sex, in some cases, casual sex. And some, you know, and I think a lot of people objected to that. Just on the grounds of, you know, talking about sex is putting ideas into kids' heads and, you know, you're MTV and you're supposed to speak to teenagers, so you should never talk about sex because if you don't say it, they'll never get the idea, you know, that kind of philosophy, which obviously I think we've all been teenagers and we know that you'll get the idea no matter what.
Yeah, yeah. Do you keep in touch with any of the cast members?
Occasionally. Occasionally I'll talk to some of them, not regularly. When the original Teen Mom, we thought it was ending, but it turned out it was just a hiatus. But when it ended after four seasons, I don't think I ever would have left had that not happened, because I was so invested in my relationship with them and that partnership and telling those stories and feeling really responsible for those stories. But then when it did, I hadn't really had a day off in almost 5 years. You know, I was like exhausted. And I stepped away, and it was really helpful to not have daily contact the way that I had for 4 or 5 years with a lot of them. But I wouldn't say that I have an ongoing relationship with them, but the door is open and I still have a lot of care for them and am happy when I get to talk to them every now and then.
Mm-hmm. And they're like in their, what, they're in their 30s now.
Yeah, they're grownups.
Oh my gosh, that is crazy. Do you think this show could be made today and have the same cultural impact, or are we all kind of reality TV poisoned and unable to be good cast members in the way that they were?
Yeah, the show is still being made.
Right.
There still are, I mean, the like, Teen Mom, but it has evolved over the years.
Right. Like OG felt like a different show than what is on today.
Yeah, and I think that the show had to evolve to respond to the fact that, you know, it got to a point even when I was there that it became very hard to produce around the fact that they were well known. You know, they were on the cover of Us Weekly. There were paparazzi outside their houses in, you know, a random town in Indiana. It was very strange. And we were kind of trying to produce around that for a little while. And then it became clear that, like, no, this is their lives now. And we have to really be honest about that and tell the full story. So the show has evolved in that way. But what really worked about the show was how real it was. Mm-hmm. They were just super on the ground, honest, showing the hard stuff, showing the dirty stuff, the difficult stuff. And nobody, our relationship with reality, not reality TV, but just reality and truth has changed so much mm-hmm. that I don't know if people would respond in the same way or believe it in mm-hmm. the same way.
Yeah. And finally, what role did abortion politics play in the show? Like, I mean, it was a different era. Roe v. Wade still existed. The land was covered in lollipops and candy compared to now. Like, how did the show handle abortion, and how do you think that would be different today?
As a producer of the show, you know, with some of the other producers, we would talk a lot about it. How much was the possibility of an abortion, you know, part of their stories? I think for a lot of our original stories, for those people, that was not on the table for whatever reason, having to do with their family's beliefs or their personal beliefs or, you know, various other reasons. So it didn't factor in a lot to those original stories. There was a special done that followed one of the later season 16 and pregnant girls who got pregnant again and chose abortion, and the special followed her making that choice and doing that. And I was not involved in that special, but I was there when they made it, and I was really glad that it got made and that that option was shown, because it wasn't ever really shown as part of our show, because it wasn't a choice that they were making. Mm-hmm. So I was really glad that we were able to do that special, so that was on the table as well. As like, mm-hmm. this is also an option. You know, you don't have to choose adoption or keeping the baby. There are other choices.
Yeah, you don't have to give birth.
Exactly.
You don't have to go through the whole thing because it sucks. yeah, I'm sorry. I'm so grouchy right now. 9 months pregnant. I want to roll out of here and into a hole. Okay, Kenda, final question. So you work on reality, telling women's stories. When you are like done with work, you've got like 2 hours to yourself. Imagine a world where that happens. Do you watch reality TV, or like how do you unwind? Like is watching like reality something that just reminds you of work, or do you have like another way to kind of let off steam?
There are some reality shows that I'll watch, but you know, I see all the seams and I see all the ways that they're put together. So uh-huh. they have to be really good.
What's a really good reality show?
I mean, I love Love is Blind. I think that's been fun to watch. But I tend to, if I'm going to watch reality, I'll usually watch like a competition show. Like I like the ones, Top Chef, and you know, the ones where somebody's showing off some skill they have, or I love Great British Bake Off because everyone's so nice. Mm-hmm. But one of my big takeaways working on Teen Mom is watching those girls become famous and how hard that is. You know, like what does it mean when that lens is focused on you and not always in a positive way? And it got me really interested in just like the concept of fame, and especially with women, how the fame machine kind of can chew up and spit out women. No matter what you do, you know, it doesn't matter if you are, you know, making a lot of mistakes in public or making no mistakes in public. Like if you're Britney Spears or if you're Anne Hathaway, like the fame machine is going to chew you up and spit you out no matter what, because that's what it's designed to do. So I'm just really interested in any media that kind of shines a light on that and talks about that, because I saw it and it's not great.
Yeah, I can imagine that it is not great. Well, Kenda Greenwood Moore, and thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Hysteria. I'm so glad that we were able to get you on before I took my leave. And thank you for all of your work.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of the show. So happy to be here.
Raise your hand if you want your nails to look perfect all the time. Me too. I'm Sarah Gibson-Tuttle from Olive & June, and this is exactly why we created the Manny System. We wanted to make it possible for everyone everywhere to give themselves a beautiful manicure at home. With our tools and our long-lasting polish, each manicure with our Manny System comes out to just $2. That's right, $2. No more $30, $40, $50 manis that you get at a salon and they take hours. Now you can paint your nails on your time and love them more than ever. And by the way, when people ask, who did your nails? Where did you get them done? You're going to proudly say, I did them myself. Get 20% off your first Manny System with code DIYNAIL20 at oliveandjune.com/DIYNAIL20. That's code DIYNAIL20 for 20% off at oliveandjune.com/DIYNAIL20.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who actually think Geminis are cool.
Why do we think Geminis are cool?
I like them. Okay, first of all, they are shit talkers. I love a shit talker. I love somebody who is trusted with information and should not be trusted with information.
Okay, I was just curious because that's actually what makes me a little nervous about Geminis.
Oh, yeah, I know. But that as long as you're going into the interaction being like, anything I say to this person
will be repeated.
Is going to be repeated. But they are the best. Like, if you can get a Gemini talking, you're going to learn so much.
Fair.
Incredible shit. Incredible shit. I also am trying to calm myself down because I'm about to be the mother of a Gemini.
Yeah, that's where I thought we were going.
And a Scorpio. What am I going to do? Listen, they hate each other. That's literally what Kendrick and Drake are.
They're listen, thank God you've got a Piscean ride or die. The most sensitive of the crew.
Oh, good. We need someone to cry. We need to someone.
No, wild, you can cry to me.
Or...
You can send them to me and I'll be like, now listen.
While my children are forming a squad of assassins together, you will be in the corner calling for hugs and crying. No, it's fine. I'll send them to you and I think they'll be so just like, wow, she's got feelings and they're soft and lovely instead of like...
She talks in such a low voice.
All right. Before we get to Sanity Corner / I Feel Petty, some announcements for the class. First of all, we are doing a mailbag episode, and we would love to hear from you if you have any questions you want us to answer relating to, you know, life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness. Email us at hysteria@crooked.com, and we will pick out some questions and answer those questions for you on a future show. That is hysteria@crooked.com. You can also find us on the socials, but email is probably best because it's easiest to organize. We all make bad decisions sometimes, and although you probably have a group chat with friends to dissect what's going on in your life, understanding the nightmare fuel that is Supreme Court decisions might require a law degree or three.
So let Strict Scrutiny be your guide to this decision season. From abortion bans to Trump trials, law professors and hosts Melissa Murray, Kate Shaw, and Leah Lippman decode the drama and break down everything you need to know and keep you sane in the process.
New episodes release every Monday wherever you get your podcasts and now on YouTube. Plus, keep an eye out for bonuses whenever SCOTUS tries to set the nation back 60 years or more. All right, Sandy Petty. I've actually got two today.
You do? I have a Petty.
Okay. I have a Sandy. I'll do Sandy first.
Okay.
So I've been watching Ripley on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
You told me about this. It's next up in my queue.
It's so good. It stars Andrew Scott, who played the hot priest in Fleabag season mm-hmm. two. He is incredible, first of all. Just an incredible actor, and you really get to see him portray this like complete psychopath in Ripley. Secondly, it's shot in all black and white in this way that makes you know as like a viewer that the filmmaker loves old films. Like it feels mm-hmm. like you're watching something that was made with like care and thought. And then also it's all in Italy. And so it's just like beautiful. Like the way that he shoots Naples.
That's what we need.
It's just, it's beautiful. And it's also very, like, there are some really long scenes of Ripley in a pickle where he doesn't talk and he's just trying to like figure out how to like clean up a mess or like, you know, I'm not trying to give anything away, but I think most people saw The Talented Mr. Ripley where he's trying to like, I've done something bad. How do I clean up after myself? And there's like long, long scenes where he's not talking at all. And it's just riveting. And I can't explain why. It's like my comfort show, even though it's about a crazy guy.
Whatever. I can't wait to get into it.
It's so good. Why don't you go with petty?
Okay, Erin, here's my petty. So obviously, because I follow the pasta grannies and I've liked some posts about Sophia Loren, I am now served Al Capone content because all Italians are the same. And many people will know Al Capone, one of America's most notorious mob bosses, bootlegger, a killer. But Erin, did you know that he is the reason we have expiration dates on milk?
What?
Wait for it. After his niece became extremely sick from spoiled milk, the gangster lobbied aggressively for expiration dates for the safety of children and pregnant women. And like, you know, after that, he started a dairy business. But okay, fine. He's allowed to do that. Then I read that Capone ran a soup kitchen during the Depression that served 2,000 meals a day in Chicago.
Wow, that's interesting.
Okay, so all this to say, I think Al Capone's a better person than Donald Trump.
I think probably he is. Escobar had a similar civic streak in Medellin, Colombia. Like if you fly into Medellin now, I haven't spent any time there, but I like transferred flights there once. It is gleaming. It is like a really—
Really?
Yeah, because he needed the protection of like and goodwill of people in the town. So he like invested a lot in like the city infrastructure and like— Yeah.
That is a lot of what, if you continue reading, as I did, about Al Capone, that obviously some of this was like PR. But at the same time, I'm like, Donald Trump went down to Puerto Rico after a hurricane and just launched some paper towels into a crowd. So it's like, if you— I'm all for people doing things for PR if it's nice and helps people. So I just— but I really, I was sitting there late at night having like night sweats. And I was like reading about Al Capone. And I was like, wait, I think Al Capone's a nicer person than Donald Trump.
That's interesting. I also think that like, I mean, ultimately Donald, this is going to sound really bad. Like that old, you know, that tweet that's like, you do not gotta hand it to Hitler, whatever, you know that?
Right. Yes.
Right. Al Capone was, he killed some people, which isn't great, but I—
Valentine's Massacre. No, not, I am not saying he's a good person.
He's not a good person.
Saying I think he might be a better person than Donald Trump.
Right. And I think maybe the only reason Donald Trump hasn't killed people is because he is scared.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, whatever. Stay scared, pony boy.
Yeah.
So here's my petty. I've talked about Miss Rachel on this show.
Love Miss Rachel.
Miss Rachel is literally our generation's Mr. Rogers. And she makes content on YouTube that people can access for free. She includes all different kinds of faces and voices in that content and, you know, has been a voice in favor of like LGBTQ rights. She's gone to Washington to promote paid family leave and affordable childcare to all. And I think like a week and a half ago, she started raising money for a Save the Children fund that was going to go to kids in Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan, and Democratic
War
Republic.
War zones.
Yeah, Democratic Republic of the Congo. And she was doing that by just making cameos for people and donating all of that money, which is like, there's nothing objectionable about that.
No.
But she was bullied in response to that by Zionists and people who have a problem with her giving to a fund that supports children in Gaza or even mentioning Gaza. That is the impression that we've gotten. That's shitty.
Helping kids is where is the crime?
The most no-brainer thing. Like, children shouldn't live in war zones. It's horrible.
No.
Like, so she, you know, put up a video about being bullied where she was crying. And one thing that I found kind of inspiring about it was the wave of content I was served in response that was like, we ride at dawn for Ms. Rachel. and the amount of support and love that she has. And she's been back on social media. I think that she wasn't chased away by the bullying that she received. So that's a good thing. But like, if you're bullying Ms. Rachel, you have lost the plot.
100%.
You've 100% lost the plot. She's wonderful, and don't you dare fucking make her feel bad.
Don't leave Miss Rachel out of your mouth.
Leave Miss Rachel alone. Okay, those are my final thoughts before I leave on maternity leave. Oh gosh, Alyssa Mastromonaco, thank you so much for being my ride or die. Kenda Greenwood Morin, thank you so much for joining me for the interview. Listeners, if you want to get in touch, hysteria@crooked.com. I'm going to be out of the communication zone for the next couple of months, but our producers and Alyssa will be able to see your messages. We love hearing from you.
Always.
And we are off next week for Memorial Day, but when Alyssa comes back on June 6th, you are going to be so excited by her amazing co-host. So you will be in great hands.
You know me. I just want to not tank the pod while you're gone.
All right. Goodbye for now.
Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on IG, Twitter, and TikTok. Subscribe to Hysteria on YouTube for access to video versions of your favorite segments and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a nice review. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Fiona Pestana is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. We get audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our video producers are Rachel Gajewski and Megan Patzel. And thank you to Julia Beach, Awa Okolate, Adia Hill, and David Tolles for production support every week.
If you're on the lookout for a true crime show with just as many twists and turns as today's political news, we've got a podcast for you. The Hargan women seem to have it all until millionaire businesswoman Pamela Hargan and her daughter Helen were found dead in their home. In the new 48 Hours limited series, Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, detectives unpack the web of evidence from the complex case, revealing motives of jealousy, sibling rivalry, and a family fortune. Was it a murder-suicide or staged to look like one? This is a story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings from 48 Hours, wherever you get your podcasts.